We're going to now turn to questions from the audience, but before I do that, I'd like to take a moment, if I could, to recognize our question review team. These are the individuals that are responsible for selecting the questions that will be presented to our speakers. So let me just ask you to hold your applause until I introduce all of them. Doug McKnight, who's a reporter for KAZU Radio. Don Miller, editor-in-chief of the Santa Cruz Sentinel. Claudia Melendez Salinas, who's a reporter for the Monterey County Herald. And Joseph Truscott, who is a features editor for the Salinas Californian. If you would thank them for the work that they do. And we also, as we usually do, have a group of students with us this evening. I'd like to ask all of the students that are here in attendance to please stand. And will you please remain standing until I finish recognizing each of the schools that you represent. We've got students from Everett Alvarez High School, from California State University Monterey Bay, from Monterey High, and from Seaside High. If you will thank them. Thank you. Student participation is important to these series and getting students to be able to get involved in talking about these issues is important to us. Sylvia and I, the Panetta Institute Board of Directors, are very grateful for those who sponsor these student programs. We bring students from high schools, colleges, and universities throughout the Central Coast to participate. So I'd appreciate it if you would give all of our sponsors a great hand as well. All right, let's turn to some of the questions here. The first question, the Sandy Hook shooter stole the guns from his mother. What law could prevent this? Chief?
He didn't steal them. All right. The mother gave and gifted the guns to the child. Certainly, parent responsibility here. Safekeeping of weapons is absolutely essential. We see this played out over and over again. The weapons simply aren't secured and kept safe. Happened in my jurisdiction the first day of school. But it's larger than Newtown. Newtown's a terrible tragedy. I think it woke us up as a nation. It caused us to stay laser focused on the issue. But it's about all these other crimes of violence that are taking place. And what measures can we take to reduce it even further? We have an obligation as a society, our role in the human experience, to do everything we can to save lives. And I think certainly a background check will do that.
Let me ask you, Chief. We talked about 300 million guns that are out there in circulation. Give me your view with regards to the correlation between guns and violence. I mean, tell me what the relationship is.
Well, certainly weapons are frequently used in crimes of violence, even if they're not discharged, used to commit robbery and so forth. And I'm not so much terribly worried about the figure of 300 million guns. It's the millions of guns in the hands of people who should not have them. Straw purchasing, for example. This is a serious problem in Maryland and California and across the great nation. And certainly measures can be taken to stop this trafficking. And we're doing that. There are bills in place that call for extensive criminal penalties for trafficking and straw purchasing.
Asa, you are a U.S. attorney. Tell me your, the relationship you see between guns and violence.
Well, it's primarily in the drug crimes, and Congress made a very serious statement when they did a mandatory minimum penalty of 10 years for a firearm being used in the commission of a violent crime. That is a heavy, heavy hand, and as it rightfully should be. And so they've recognized that there is a escalation of a crime whenever a firearm is used. And so it enhances the seriousness of the crime when a firearm is used. I don't know that there's a connection between the heart of the assailant, because if you took all the firearms out of society and somebody wanted to hurt somebody, they'd find out another means of doing it. It could be an axe or knife or some other weapon. But a recognition that a firearm enhances the severity of it, and Congress has responded with a very serious penalty.
Since the U.S. is one of the largest arms manufacturers and distributors in the world, how does this influence the debate over the rights of citizens to bear arms? Sarah?
That's kind of a tough one. Why'd you wait to give that one to me? Could you repeat the question? Give me a moment to think.
U.S. is one of the largest arms manufacturers and distributors in the world. How does that influence the debate over the rights of citizens to bear arms?
Well, I think one of the things we have to think about is that they are combined into the overall gun lobby are very influential in entering into the political debate that's involved. They're able to put a lot of money into it, into the debate, and to make it look as though they represent a large, large part of the country. And that's very problematic as far as I'm concerned. It should not be large money, whether it be on our side or on your side, that should be deciding these large issues. It should be public policy, sound public policy. What works best in order to achieve the results that we want achieved, which are less deaths and injuries by guns.
Jumping on the issue, I think the NRA spent something like $25 million with regards to candidates' races. And now Mayor Bloomberg is likely to pump in another, few million dollars of his own money into doing it. He's running ads in a lot of areas right now as we speak. Is that going to help or hurt getting a compromise?
I think it elevates the issue. There's going to be a lot of money spent in this next election on both sides of the coin talking about the issue of gun regulation. Hopefully that just simply helps the American people to vote knowledgeably and not just on the political side, but they just think it through. Now, maybe I'm being naive and optimistic on that, but the American people control this issue, and they will elect people that will vote their will on this issue, and I think the debate is healthy. And, I'm troubled, on both sides in some ways, but Mayor Bloomberg's got a right of free speech, and I disagree with what he's saying, but he's got a right to say it. And in my state, we got Remington Arms as a manufacturer. We manufacture ammunition in Arkansas. They got a right to speak too, and they're meeting the needs of people who want to be able to purchase that product.
Should gun licenses require a vigorous training program, Chief?
Absolutely. In states that choose to have licensing, I think a training program that's reasonable is quite appropriate. And don't confuse the issue of licensing with a national registry. If you walk out anything here tonight on this issue, there's federal laws that prohibit a national registry. When that form 4473 is filled out, it's kept at the gun dealer. And in fact, in the bill that was just introduced, there's a 15-year penalty for a public safety official who even attempts to keep any form of gun ownership registry. So they're two separate issues, but licensing, a training program, 4 hours, I don't think that's unreasonable.
Should community relations and education be the main way to heal, to be able to heal society and its violence?
I think you'd look at the pathology of the issue, the underlying causes. And we were talking before we walked in, to look at the mental health aspects. And, you know, for me, one of the most disappointing things about that bill that was struck down or wasn't voted through, it was nearly a 70-page bill. $100 million a year for states to enhance their automated systems to enter mental health records into NICS. Another section, nearly 20 pages, that helped define what are mental health disqualifiers for the first time nationally. You know, how we classify you get into the NICS system. Another part of the bill calling for a national commission on mass violence. All these measures, I think, holistically taken together, begin to address the pathology, the underlying cause of firearms violence.
So let me ask you along those lines. You were in charge of the report that came out with regards to school violence and what to do about it, and you suggested arming at most of the schools, and it obviously created a large reaction. Tell me a little bit about the study and what it provided, and how you respond to the concern about arming, providing more arms at each of the schools in terms of security guards.
Our study was really the response to Sandy Hook, which was a question you asked earlier. And former Secret Service, former Homeland Security officials, school safety experts reviewed for 3 months our situation in the schools and made a very serious series of recommendations involving perimeter security, access controls, badging, and including, though, the increasing school resource officers or armed guards in the schools. Important point is that, one, every decision should be made by the local school district. So if Los Angeles or some school doesn't want a firearm for protection, that's the local school district's decision. But we do believe that a school is, Sandy Hook had no protection. And I actually met with one of the parents of the Sandy Hook tragedy, and the mom said, I hope never again a teacher has got to put her body between an assailant and the child. And we need others that can protect. And so that was part of our recommendation. But part of it, let me come back to the mental health equation. And I know this is to bring people together, and I genuinely believe that this is an area that we need to have a serious bipartisan effort on. And it did get pulled out of the bill. I think there's a lack of agreement, even the medical community, on how to handle mental health information, whether it violates HIPAA, whether they ought to disclose it, and how privacy works there. This is a very serious effort. It's going to take some time to work through, but that the mental health equation is something we ought to be able to work together on, and it's a large part of violence in our society.
Sarah, you agree with that?
Partly. I think there's such a misunderstanding, however, about mental illness and violence. Less than 2% of anybody who's mentally ill is ever even prone to violence. So that I think if you get into rights, you have to stop and look at the rights of somebody not to have, to be singled out just because they're mentally ill. But very definitely, we need to get those who've been adjudicated mentally ill up and on the NICS system. 25, 30 years ago, when the Brady Bill was written, no records were up on any kind of federal system at all. And many, many states still had their records, their felony records in shoeboxes. Many of them didn't have the disposition of any of the trials involving a gun, so that even if you found out one thing, you'd have to go to another shoebox to find another. So we have come a long way in 20 years. Now we have a federal system. It has to be upgraded. And the validity of the material that's in that system has to protect everybody's rights, not just those who've been adjudicated mentally ill, but nobody should be in that system who is not a felon or a fugitive.
Let's go on to this question. Is gun violence significantly, statistically worse, or does media coverage disproportionately skew our understanding of the prevalence of the problem? Does the media perhaps perpetuate the problem?
It's a major problem for public safety, my jurisdiction, and all across America. As we've stated, gun violence is down over the last decade. We know that. However, you know, with the news we have available to us today, at 6 in the morning, at 7, if you want to catch an 11 o'clock show, and if you get home early in Baltimore, you can catch it at 4, 5, 6. If you still haven't had enough, catch the 10 o'clock Fox 45. And if you're a complete junkie, then you turn to one of the cable channels. It's like we're just consumed. And they talk about the arrest and the indictment and the appeal process. And which case am I talking about? You get confused. Is that the one I heard about 2 weeks ago? So we walk away with this in my community. In fact, I'm sitting in Baltimore right now. My community thinks that it's out of control. It's out of control. No, it's down 26%, I tell them. It's a major problem.
What? I think you would agree with that.
We have agreement.
Let me ask you, your crime rate is down. What are the reasons it's gone down in Baltimore?
Incarceration of repeat violent offenders. Good old school police work. I think the quality is a lot better today. What I mean by that is we all hire people to work on our houses or our cars or to build or the lawyers to do whatever we need them to do. And cops are better today. They're better today than they were when I came on. We're educated. We're passionate about their work. Technology. We're catching that repeat violent offender on a second or third robbery where he either threatens or shoots someone rather than the eighth, ninth, or tenth. So I think those things collectively certainly are having a huge impact.
Let me ask you, Asa, because you know this is obviously a statement we've heard a lot from Wayne LaPierre. The only way to stop a bad guy with a gun is with a good guy with a gun. And I guess you know what that basically means is a hell of a lot more weapons out there. So that everybody, you know, carries around a weapon. I guess the question is, you know, having this kind of arms race take place in society, isn't it going to, ultimately, doesn't it mean that violence will occur more quickly and that people will develop even, you know, more larger weapons to try to deal with the potential that they're going to run into somebody with a gun? I mean, just, you know the arguments with regards to...
I do, Wayne LaPierre has a way of planting the flag in the ground in dramatic terms. But put that in perspective of, as the chief has said, gun violence has fallen dramatically over the past two decades. So you got to put it in perspective. In terms of, is a good guy with a gun the only way possible to stop a bad guy with a gun? No. If you had a police officer living in your home, well, I guess he's a good guy with a gun. Or if you had the government to protect you, then perhaps you don't need to have citizens carrying guns, is the point. But the fact is that we don't have sufficient police officers. We don't have in every school, a school resource officer. Sandy Hook did not have that. And so that's the context of that statement. That's the context of our recommendations that as long, what do we have a greater responsibility for than the children of our nation, those who go to school? So let's provide protection for them, if we're going to have protection when they go into a shopping mall. And so I think that's the context, that we do need to have the capability to stop the bad guys.
Sarah?
I think certainly if the best way to stop the gun violence, if it depended upon how many guns there were, we'd be the safest nation on earth already. I mean, we have more guns than anybody. So I don't know that that's quite the way to look at it. I mentioned before about the best armed people were with my husband, and it certainly didn't help there. Does this mean that we want to put armed guards surrounding every movie theater in the future? And then when we have mass shootings in a bar, are we going to put a bunch of cops everywhere around a bar? Instead, what are they talking about is letting people carry weapons into bars. It's kind of gotten crazy, and we are on opposite sides, and thank goodness we're going to have more discussions, I hope, like tonight.
Chief, what do you, you deal with this all the time.
When Wayne made that statement at the Senate Judiciary hearing, my response was that one of the best ways to stop a bad guy from getting a gun in the first place is a good background check. So, definitely there are some reasonable measures that I think we all can live with. We can walk away with a win-win. And again, I know I keep coming back to the background check, but it's so simple to me. The system's already in place nationally. It's not going to cost us tremendous amounts as a society. And it's highly effective. Nearly 2 million prohibited purchases were stopped during the first 10 years. Brady Bill.
This is an interesting question. I didn't realize this was the case. What can be done about three-dimensional printing technology that has the ability to make civilian assault rifles without serial numbers? How can we control or regulate their production?
Well, I've seen this as well, and it's developing technology. But in the state of Maryland, it's the sale and manufacture of. So I think that would be covered. So we've had this debate in the state of Maryland. But certainly law enforcement continues to watch this developing technology, and it is a concern.
Let me, as long as the assault weapon issue was raised here, you know, when the Brady Bill was passed, soon after that we passed an assault weapons ban, and I guess there was a 10-year limit on it, and that 10-year expired. I guess we did it with magazines as well.
That sunshined.
Right.
After.
The argument is that, you know, obviously you don't need an assault weapon to shoot ducks or shoot deer. But the argument that's raised is obviously for self-defense. I guess the question I would ask you, Asa, is where, if you argue that you need assault weapons for self-defense, where is that line? Do you need bazookas? Do you need tanks? Do you need, artillery? Where do you draw the line on that argument?
Well, you draw the line where our elected officials draw the line first, and then the Supreme Court interprets that, and whether it's a burden on the Second Amendment. Obviously, I've prosecuted people with military-type weapons that were illegal. They're illegal now. They've been illegal for decades, that you can't have an wall weapon. You can't have a machine gun, which is automatic fire. Those are illegal now and have been for decades. When you talk about assault weapons, they're really assault style, which is a semi-automatic weapon. And a semi-automatic weapon means that you have to pull the trigger every time. An automatic weapon, you pull it and it just has automatic fire. And so a semi-automatic weapon, we have historically said, is legal because it takes a single pull of the trigger every time. Now, I have a semi-automatic weapon. Now, if you put it all in colorful fashion, it becomes an assault-style weapon because they make it look different, like it's a pretend military-style weapon. You know, that's I think there's a lot of misnomers and a lot of misinformation there. It is a political debate as to whether the people believe that will actually be a useful restriction on the Second Amendment. I don't think so, and for this reason, I don't think it solves the problem of violence in our society. And I think we ought to address things that make us safer, that reduce violence in our society. The chief pointed to one thing, which were the incarceration rates. We're actually having repeat offenders kept in jail, violent offenders. That's made a huge difference in our society, and the enforcement of the laws made a big difference in our society.
Chief, what's your feeling about
that?
Well,
I certainly think when you take a look at the assault weapon itself, the way it's engineered and it's designed, its intent, I know you're going to see a lot more people this fall in Maryland in the woods with an assault rifle. They want to show you they're using it for hunting. I suppose you can hunt with that weapon. I mean, they're going to do it. You know, and another thing, too, with this assault weapon, and this issue is going to come up. In the Heller case, the language was whether or not an assault weapon was an unusual, or in this case, is an unusual weapon. And if you did something 1% of the time in your life, would you say that's an unusual event? I say it would be. Well, there are about 1% of the weapons that are out there right now, best we can tell. So I think that language of unusual is going to be very significant as time marches on, as that assault weapon becomes 5%, 10%. Is it so unusual anymore? So you're going to lose that argument in the court. But certainly the design, the engineer of the weapon, the way it's designed to cool, to fire round after round after hundreds of rounds, certainly the way that the weapon has quickly detachable magazines that could be fitted with, I have several 120 round magazines in my evidence room. They're two cylinders where the rounds go up through the center. And the damn thing weighs nearly 8 pounds to begin with. And we need this. My police officers generally are carrying 30 round magazines. It's the weight problem. It's just too much weight. So I would argue that you have to look at the design and the intent of the weapon, how it was engineered, and what it was engineered for.
Speaking of that, let's talk about the magazines. I think, at least in the proposal, the limit was to limit a magazine to 10 rounds.
Is that correct?
And although the argument was, you can move these things, you can change them pretty quickly. I guess the question is, why do you need more than 10 rounds, in a magazine?
I'll just use this illustration that I went backpacking in Alaska. And we found out there's some grizzly bears up there. My wife, who's sitting here, said, "I want you carrying more than a whistle." And so I go to Academy Sports, and I say, "I'm going up in grizzly bear country. What do I need to have for protection?" And they said, "You need to have a Springfield 45 automatic, semi-automatic, 13 caliber weapon. That would be illegal under the president's proposal with a 10-round capacity limit. I bought this because it was recommended as the best protection for traveling in grizzly bear country in Alaska. So I think that's reasonable. And so, if you're talking about 50 caliber, if you're talking about, or 50 magazine clip, or you're talking about more, there's a legitimate debate that will take place on that.
Is there no limitation in terms of the number of bullets in a magazine right now?
It depends state to state. Maryland was 20. And you say to yourself, well, what's the purpose? Where did they come up with this, no more than 10? And it's the reload. It's the reload process. You can say, well, Jim, I could reload that thing in 2.5 seconds. Well, you probably could in a nice, calm environment at the range with no stress. But in a chaotic shooting event, the horrific horror of that event? Could you do it in 2.5 seconds? Think about that. And certainly that reload process allows a person maybe the chance, the split chance, to seek cover, concealment, or if they're in a position to do so, attack the adversary, as they did in Gabby Gifford's shooting. That was the game changer. That change of that magazine allowed an ordinary citizen, you, sitting in the audience, a chance to intervene and save lives. That's why it's so important.
Asa?
Well, just a counterpoint on that, though. You said that it sometimes will take a couple seconds to change that, and in the heat of the moment, it becomes even more difficult in with your adrenaline flowing. So if you're a private citizen and you have an assailant coming into your home, do you want to be limited to a less than 10 capacity magazine whenever you know how nervous you're going to get in the heat of that moment? Do you want to have more protection?
That's what they just say here. This would be my husband's Let's Arm Bears, since they're so dangerous up there. It's time to let's arm bears. I think you have to decide how many citizens are going to be saved in either situation. And I don't think we should look at it as far as the convenience standard goes, but as far as how many lives are going to be saved. So many of the ultra-conservative gun owners, and that's, I want to say that the NRA has upheld, their membership has upheld good laws, like the Brady Law, like the ban, background checks, and the assault weapons bans even. So we're not talking about a very large number of people here who really are going to worry themselves to death about grizzly bears in Alaska. And if they are, I think they need to hire a guide.
Or they have to be able to run faster than the guys.
Then they get a sled.
Is there? I mean, this deals with obviously the concern about gun laws in general. Is there any reason to believe that the U.S. government would ever have the authority to confiscate guns?
Anybody? I have four. Respect for the Constitution and my government and the fact that we, throughout the years, have put a series of balances and, you know what I'm talking checks. About, checks and balances, to make sure our government runs correctly. And I'm an old enough coot to have seen our whole way of thinking change in my lifetime. Anybody younger than I am probably hasn't. But we'll have ebbs and flows on one side or the other. But the thought that our government could be overtaken, or that we could be overtaken by our government, I just don't think exists at all. And certainly, guns are going to have nothing to do with it. If they were going to be able to get a hold of a list of gun owners, they just need to go to the NRA headquarters. If they really wanted to do away with us, I think there are other places ways they might do it other than marching through the streets grabbing our guns.
Asa?
I would like to think our government would never take any action to confiscate the guns of citizens. I would also like to think that our government would never investigate a group because of a philosophy that they held.
Chief?
I could take this. I've been involved in hundreds of meetings, more than I care to count. At no time have I been a party to any discussion that this was step one. And as a gun owner myself, as a hunter, someone who enjoys going to the range constantly, I would hope my government, that the police that protect me when I retire, would never do such a thing. I used the word, I think, during that hearing is creepy. Maybe I shouldn't have said that, but to me, it's just terribly alarming that some see their government that way.
Let me, along those lines, it raises a whole concern about registration, obviously. And yet, you know, I was thinking, every state requires that you register your car, and they require you to register it almost every year. Why the concern if we accept the registration of our cars, the registration of those that own guns? Give me the fear issue as to why people are concerned about that.
Back to the question as to whether the government will ever confiscate guns. I don't think they're going to whenever the citizens have 300 million guns. they would use them. But in terms of the registration, the fear is that government misuses databases. You compare it to vehicles, you compare it to there's not a Second Amendment or a Third Amendment that protects the your private ownership of a vehicle, or that you shouldn't be licensed or registered. Obviously, that's a condition of using the highways in our country. But you know, the fear is, and you can say it's reasonable or unreasonable, but the fear is, of course, that if you have registration that is forms a database, that can be misused by the government in some fashion. It might be not for the purpose of confiscation, but it could be for the turning over to IRS for the identification of right-wing groups or those that belong to, are inappropriate in some fashion. It's just a misuse, and I'm an optimist about our government, and I trust our government to the extent that I think there's good people in there, but we have to have the right checks and balances, and there's a legitimate fear about the registration where we lead.
Chief, let me ask you, one of the concerns raised on the background checks was that it would lead to registration, and that it would lead to a data bank that the government would have. Is there a way to really protect against that happening?
Well, certainly today the federal law prohibits a national registry of gun owners. And let me repeat that. Current federal law prohibits a national registry. In the last draft of the Manchin-Toomey bill, I believe, again, it was a 15-year sentence for public safety that attempts to maintain such a list. But let me tell you how important it is, though, for a dealer just to maintain records. You're a police officer, it's 2 o'clock at night, you get called to a shooting. You have a body, and you do your search, and you find a gun behind the hedges. You know, it's a Smith & Wesson, you can have a serial number on it. Well, where do you start? How do you work with that? You have no witnesses, all right, where do you go? Well, what happens is you simply then will contact the tracing officials. They'll tell you who the manufacturer sold the gun to, the middle person. He'll tell you what gun dealer actually acquired the gun. My detectives go into the gun dealer. They say, John, could we see the records on this gun? John goes to his metal file cabinet, goes to his papers, not required to keep it automated, and hopefully he still has the record. And then you have some place to start as a detective. So that's how the system currently works. And there's no proposal to alter it, whether you live 20 miles or inside the city. There's no proposal to alter that. Keep the system you have. It works.
Let me, we're down to a couple of minutes here. Let me ask each of you, what do you think the chances are in the Congress to develop a compromise with regards to this whole issue establishing some limits here? Asa?
I think it's minimal in the Congress right now. I mean, the most minimalist bill was defeated in a Democrat Senate. So I think the debate really is in state by state, as they've already, in various states, enacting legislation and the public debating it. So I think that's where the debate's going to be in the future.
So you don't really expect that the Congress is going to be able to pass any kind of limit?
Not in the near future. Obviously, if the American people speak differently, elect different people, then that impacts the makeup of Congress, but not in the short term.
Well, I think Congress is dysfunctional, so I agree with you that they're not going to do that. Sarah, what do you think?
Well, I think we're going to get it eventually. Do I think we're going to get it this session or before the next election is very doubtful. I am so appreciative that this new generation of people are here and fighting for good laws, and they are doing a spectacular. This chief and chiefs around the country and cops all over the country, rank and file, are working hard. And they're going to be successful. They definitely are. I think the political situation's hard now.
Chief?
I remain optimistic that you will see a national background bill passed. Five votes. It fell five votes short of a supermajority. Did you know such a thing even existed, a supermajority? I've learned so much from this process.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm very confident you'll see a national background check. And I do agree that individual states need to step up to the plate, and certainly many have over the last 6 months and many more to come.
Well, let me ask you something. If they beat the hell out of these people that voted against it and get them to come around, and it passes the Senate, is it going to have any chance in the House?
Well, some folks that they're popularity polls went up, and I stayed nonpartisan this whole process, and others dipped.
Thank you very much. Thanks all three of you for being here this evening. Appreciate it.
You've been listening to the third in the Leon Panetta Lecture Series. Tonight's topic, gun control, the Second Amendment, are there limits?